And welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, ecology, stories from the land, recipes, relationships, and life itself. We're your hosts, Helge Hellberg.
And Mark Mulcahy.
And we are excited about the show today. We have some amazing guests lined up as we are discussing land ethic, what it is, why it is beautiful, and why it is so important. All the efforts across the nation for eco-literacy and a new relationship with the land. All that and more here today on An Organic Conversation. And Mark, what's happening in life and produce?
Well, what's happening in life is I was just appreciating the land ethic last night when I was sitting out on the porch, and just it was the time where the bats had stopped flying around, and it was just cool enough that I could just be with the stars and the grass and the oak trees, and it was pretty amazing just to take that moment and be part of it, be part of all that. As far as produce is concerned, today we're talking about something that Americans eat about 8 pounds of a year.
Chips? So,
well, yeah, well, actually, that would probably be more than that, but we'll find out. But first, we get to hear from Gina Rastani with the Green Headlines.
Thank you, Mark. In world news, a study conducted by the International Union for Conservation of Nature found that 5 out of 8 tuna species are at risk of extinction. Experts warn that all 3 bluefin tuna species, Southern Atlantic and Pacific, are susceptible to collapse due to overfishing. In other news, a recent study from the Brookings Institution found that the green economy employs more people than the fossil fuel industry at about 2.7 million workers. That's 2% of all U.S. jobs. The study also found that median wages in the clean economy are 13% higher than the median U.S. wage. And as for the goods produced, the clean economy exports are valued at twice as much per job. In supermarket news, Mark, you'll like this. Albertsons Supermarkets announced it will transition 40 stores nationwide to zero waste operations by the end of February 2012. They will divert at least 90% of their waste through various programs, including recycling, composting, and contributing to a food bank donation program. Domestic sales of the highly anticipated Nissan Leaf are gaining speed, even though the electric vehicle is only available in 7 U.S. states. It has already sold over 4,000 units in just 8 months. The Nissan Leaf is also the World Car of the Year for 2011 and a top safety pick from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. I'm Gina Rastani, and that was this week's Green Headlines.
Wow, the Nissan Leaf safety pick and... Mark, amazing. Why only 7 states? Do we know?
Exact same thing.
What about the other states?
Yeah, why would only Justice. 7 states have it be sold in those states?
Gina, do we know?
No.
We'll find out for you. That's not okay. 7 states. But anyway, 7 states feature the new Nissan Leaf. Have you seen it? Beautiful. It looks like a Peugeot. I'm not sure if you know a Peugeot.
I do.
It's a French... Mm-hmm. I don't know why that's so funny, but that's what comes to mind. It's like a sportier Prius, if I may say. It has a little bit of a shark or a duck nose, like a beak, like it has a little mouth, like, you know, like a Lotus or whatever, those cars. So it's kind of an interesting kind of sporty, it looks a little bit French to me, mm-hmm. blend of all those good attributes. The back looks like a Volvo. So what else can we name here?
We could call it a... Well, it is.
Anyway, it's a full electric car. Amazing. We got comments on a recent show where we talked about electric cars that it's important to see where your power for that car comes from, because mm-hmm. it's still electricity made from something, even though tapping into the grid is a much more sustainable source. But if that power comes from, you know, nuclear coal or mm-hmm. clean coal, which doesn't really exist, that is something to be checked up on too. And I know now hotels offer electric vehicles, or hybrids at least, that are charged on solar powered. I know the W Hotel does that, for uh-huh. example. Amazing.
Mm-hmm. And so you could either bring in your Tesla, or you could bring in your Leaf and park it right in the W Hotel.
And even Tesla is working on a new car. So thank you, Gina. That's a big news. Mm-hmm. Nissan Leaf. Mm-hmm. We'll look for it. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we will take a quick break, but stay tuned for our first interview about land ethic today, our relationship with the natural world. Today on An Organic Conversation, more on that when we come back right after the break. And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we're talking about land ethic and our relationship to the natural world. And we picked this topic because we have that relationship to the natural world anyway. We have it. It is maybe neglected. It is maybe argued about. But there's a certain truth in our relationship to the land that 20 years later we may discover through some environmental impacts that were unforeseeable or through a better understanding, which is the focus of this week's show, of how we can improve our relationship to the existing world outside of us. And as we take care of the world outside of us, we usually take care of the world inside of us right with it. We're excited about the topic and excited about our guests today. Our first guest is the executive director of the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Aldo Leopold really coining the term land ethic some 60 years ago, way ahead of its time, or as timely as needed back then, to now blossom into a national and international movement. The executive director of the Aldo Leopold Foundation, Buddy Huffaker, calling in from Baraboo, Wisconsin. Buddy, thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here. I hope you can hear me just fine. I'm actually not calling from Baraboo, but rather Bozeman, Montana, as part of the beginnings of the world tour of the Green Fire film distribution, so which I think we could talk about later, but I'm just pleased to be joining you today.
So instead of Baraboo, Wisconsin, you're calling in from Bozeman, Montana. both are full-named, full-mouth cities, beautiful. And you're right in the topic of today. We invited you to be on the show because of an amazing new documentary, one of the most moving documentaries I've seen in a long time. It's called Green Fire, and it describes the life and world of Aldo Leopold and his findings. And Aldo Leopold is one of those, best hidden secrets, no offense, but he's not nationally known as maybe one of the most important environmental pioneers in the 1930s and 40s, writing the Sand County Almanac, really the Rachel Carson of its time back then, and his work as influential and as important as we've never seen it before now. Can you talk a little bit about Aldo Leopold and his early work, who he was and what his realizations were?
Yeah, as you said, he's most well known as the author of his now classic book, A Sand County Almanac, which was published posthumously a year after his death in 1948. He's credited widely by those kind of in the know, I think, as you describe, in the conservation environmental movement, as being the father of our country's, North America's wilderness movement and idea, as well as wildlife management, has influenced fields such as ecological restoration, and even has a Center for Sustainable Agriculture named after him. So his impacts, while maybe not fully known to the general public, are pretty widespread and diverse among those that kind of practice and work daily in advancing the concept of sustainability, or as he would have defined it, a land ethic. And really, there are kind of two ingredients, I think, that went into his rise to fame within the community of kind of those that know about him. One is that he was really one of our first professionally trained conservationists. So he went to the Yale School of Forestry, graduated in 1909, and joined the U.S. Forest Service. So was really one of the first people employed in that clean economy, I guess, if you would call it back then, looking at protecting, restoring, and managing our natural resources. He then, over the course of his lifetime, experienced all sorts of ecological challenges and catastrophes, such as the Dust Bowl and World War II. And then in the mid-30s, found himself purchasing a worn-out farm along the Wisconsin River outside of Baraboo, Wisconsin, and began to restore it to health by planting thousands and thousands of trees every year. And it was through that experience, as kind of moving out of the public sector and as a private citizen of taking care of a piece of land that inspired him to write his book, A Sand County Almanac. And then just quickly to add, you know, I think part of the effort is to illuminate his writing, his thoughts, his ideas, and his prominence within our thinking about the natural world, because we see him as really delivering a message that is timely and relevant today. And, you know, we're excited that his book has now been translated into 11 different languages.
Yes, and we want to learn more about what the foundation does. We're talking with Buddy Huffaker, the executive director of the Aldo Leopold Foundation, calling in today from Bozeman, Montana. Aldo Leopold, and a very early environmentalist, really laying the groundwork with his findings and with his documents and journals of the environmental movement. He's kind of the John Muir of the Forest Service, being employed by the Forest Service, and so firsthand observing the changes in the land through our land management efforts and practices.
Yeah, and so what I'm wondering is, what is the goal of the foundation, the Aldo Leopold Foundation?
Well, our goal is really, you know, our stated mission is to foster a land ethic through the legacy of Aldo Leopold. And really, I think how we translate that is that it, you know, we're just trying to help others appreciate the very ideas that you guys examine in this program about how and why we need a more sustainable relationship with the natural world. And then we just use our kind of unique assets to do that. Such as we're the executor of his literary estate, so we can bring out his works in new formats and in new languages. We own and manage the property that was the inspiration for him to write the book, so we have people come literally from all over the world to Baraboo, Wisconsin, to see the place that inspired Leopold. And we've built a new visitor center that is a green building. It's built by out of trees that Aldo and his family planted in the 30s and 40s.
Oh, that's
and
beautiful.
It was, it was the first net carbon or carbon neutral building ever recognized by the U.S. Green Building Council, and it's LEED Platinum certified. So,
Buddy, can you explain, or not explain, but is there a definition directly for the term land ethic, which is something that was coined by Aldo Leopold, but how did he define that, or how would you define it today?
Yeah, I think the basic premise, and he has some beautiful descriptions that talk about expanding the boundaries of our community so that we would include things like the soil, water, air, plants, and animals into our community. And so I describe it as what he was challenging us to think about is that instead of being apart from the natural world or the biotic community, humans are actually part of the biotic community. And when we begin to think about it that way, Leopold asserted that then we would treat those other species, those other elements in our world with a lot more respect and appreciation, just as we provide that and extend that to our friends and family and neighbors.
So how was that received when he came up, when he wrote the book, and when he was an early conservationist? And he, you know, he went into the Forest Service, and that's how he was able to do some of his work in his early life when he got out of college. How was this term of land ethic received at that point in time?
I mean, we're talking 1930 and 1940, right? This is kind of ahead of the environmental movement.
That's correct. So he was a bit ahead of his time, and But we often like to say that, you know, he was not alone. There were other people thinking about these ideas, names like Paul Sears and Paul Arrington, William Vogt. But nevertheless, Leopold was kind of a spokesperson and the most eloquent in expressing these ideas. And so I think there was a core even back then that really appreciated and respected it. But, you know, he was still, I think, way out ahead of us. It was way out ahead of, you know, his time and in many ways still out ahead of us in our time in terms of really understanding how critically important these ideas are to the future of humanity.
So, I mean, I think that now brings us to the movie, The Green Fire. And can you tell us, you know, what it's about? You're here at the premiere today and what it's about and where people can see it. But mostly, let's just start with what it's about.
Yeah, it again, you know, just Leopold wrote a Sand County Almanac because he recognized the need for a communication device to share these ideas, this idea of a land ethic with many more people, to get people thinking and wondering about their relationship to the natural world. So, you know, in his day and age, a book was one of the best vehicles to do that. Well, times have changed, obviously, in recognizing the new mediums and new ways to get messages to people. And also, frankly, that film can convey emotions and ideas in a way that that literature at times can't. We decided that it was time to do a film about Leopold and his ideas. And so it's about a 70-minute film, and it explores both his life, so his biography. But in addition to that, we've tried to intersperse contemporary examples of where people have used Leopold to inspire and inform the way they engage with the natural world. It could be working ranches in the Southwest. It's urban gardening in Chicago. And so we've tried to tell Leopold's story, but also reflect that in contemporary culture.
You know, well, which is fantastic. And I know, Helga, you were telling me that you saw The Green Fire and yes. And how much it moved you.
Yeah, I would say, again, it's one of the most beautiful songs. It's almost a song of our relationship, and it doesn't try to convince you by showing destruction. It doesn't try to convince you by arguing on, you know, scientific data, even though a little bit of that is, of course, in the movie. But it's really just documenting Alder Leopold's work and not having started as an environmentalist, but having nature teach him about being an environmentalist. And that's a funny term anyway, being part of nature, being dependent upon and in relation to nature. And that makes it it's a beautiful, beautiful imagery, of course. But the underlying truth of what Alder Leopold found is so undeniable in your face when you watch it that it's an outstanding movie. Really, really good job, Buddy Huffaker, the executive director of the Alder Leopold Foundation from Baraboo, Wisconsin, calling in today from Bozeman, Montana, showing the film there. Buddy, we're almost out of time, but where can people find this? You have a great website. It's aldoleopold.org. If people want to track down the film, including viewings, or if they just want to learn more about the work that Alder Leopold has done in the 1920s and 30s and 40s with the Sand County Almanac in 1949, really one of the groundworks for today's environmental understanding. But where else will you show the movie Green Fire?
Well, we have a little bit of a lull right now in the summer, but in the fall we are having an East Coast rollout, a West Coast rollout. We're talking about the Southeast and the South. And so two things. As you said, www.aldoleopold.org/greenfire, and there's a way to sort by your state and your community to find out when the film is going to be playing near you. And if it's not scheduled, we have a community resource screening kit that is what I like to call an event in a box. It's a copy of the film with an unlimited public screening license, all sorts of background information and resources, and you can set up your own showing in your own community.
Wonderful. Again, that's aldoleopold.org, and then look for Green Fire, the movie. Thank you so much, Buddy Huffaker, the executive director of the Alder Leopold Foundation. Please continue your amazingly important work joining us today from Bozeman, Montana. Thanks for being on the show, Buddy.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. And you guys keep up your work as well.
We will. Absolutely. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helga Helberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we'll take a quick break. And we're back with more on land ethic and our relationship to the natural world. Stay tuned.
He was born in the summer of his 27th year, coming home to a place he'd never been before. He left yesterday behind him. You might say he was born again. You might say he found the key for every door. When he first came.
My name is Earl Herrick, and I am the owner of Earl's Organic Produce, a San Francisco Bay Area distributor fully committed to organic produce. From the time one could find organic fruits and vegetables only in natural food stores to now, when schools and fine restaurants feature organic, we have been forging relationships with growers for over 20 years. If you want to offer the finest organic produce to your employees or customers, find us at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Frye Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frye never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Frye organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Frye Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites, available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Do you feel run down, stressed, overweight, or overloaded? Urban Remedy is a delicious 100% organic juice cleansing program designed to jumpstart your body's natural healing and cleansing abilities. This delicious juice feast, created by leading acupuncturist Nika Pasquale, is rich in vital nutrients, minerals, and enzymes, providing you with all the nutritional nourishment you need to thrive. Delivered directly to your doorstep. Urban Remedy, a convenient way to boost your energy and balance your body. Place your order today at urbanremedy.com. That's urbanremedy.com.
Over 25 years ago, my husband and I started a business around our passion for ginger. We called it the Ginger People. Today, you can find our products at natural food stores nationwide. We love ginger. It's what we do. And the more we learned about the amazing properties of ginger, the more we realized that everyone benefits from eating ginger every day. My name is Abby Leeson, and I am with the Ginger People. To learn more about our products, the goodness of ginger, and how it can improve your health, visit gingerpeople.com. That's gingerpeople.com.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Helberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we are talking about our relationship to the natural world today on this hour. Land ethic, a term coined by Aldo Leopold. And we are now looking at the Trust for Public Land, a nonprofit that in its dedication is solely focused on conservation of beautiful natural resources. But before we get into that interview with the president of the Trust for Public Land, Will Rogers, here's Mark Mulcahy with What's in Season.
And I always have a hard time conserving the produce that I eat because it always just seems to go so fast. So we won't be conserving any produce on this show. It'll all get well used. And so at the beginning of the show, I mentioned that Americans consume 8 pounds of this wonderful fruit.
And I said fruit. Okay. I said potato chips.
And potato chips, which do come from a vegetable. And you'd think, well, 8 pounds of nectarines probably isn't that much, or watermelon, that wouldn't be hardly anything. But so I just thought, you know, my first thought went to berries or something like that. And actually, it is considered a berry, but not as you would consider a berry that comes off a bush or something. It's actually grapes, table grapes. Yes, those beautiful green, black, and red varieties that are so easy to eat and that are just bursting with flavor. Those are what we're talking about today. Table grapes. If you're eating them pretty much anywhere in the country, they're more than likely coming from California. And California produces 98% of the table grapes that we eat each summer. And there are over 60 varieties that are commercially available, but only about 14 of them that you really see in the stores when you're shopping. So what is the best grape now? when I talked a few weeks ago about the names of peaches, I'm going to go to the names of grapes too, because most of the time you just see red grape or green grape on the sign. And that's not really doing either of those justice. Because right now, if you want to eat the best red grape, it's called a Scarlet Royale. And it's a big, large, red oval grape. And those are going to be the sweetest ones. And that's what you're going to see in the store. There's a flame grape, which is red also, that's more round and medium-sized. But that's not going to be good for about another month. So you want to look for the Scarlet Royale. If you're looking for green grapes, then you probably want to look for one that's called a Sugar One. That's Sugar One. And that's a big green oval grape that is going to be the best tasting one now. And then you wait another month and Thompson Seedless will be in season. And the reason, again, why I'm mentioning it is that because we all have our own unique perspective on what tastes good. And if it's always just says green or red, then you're not going to know which one you really like and when that's in season. And, here's a really interesting thing that I was thinking of Chef Sita the other day, and she always talks about why food is so good for us. And I always thought that deep colored or brightly colored fruits and vegetables were the ones that had antioxidants, but actually green grapes have antioxidants too, almost as much as red grapes. And so don't stay away from those green grapes because you don't think they have as much nutritional value. They actually are high in vitamin C and actually have a lot of antioxidants. If you're thinking about buying grapes, once again, you should consider to buy them organic, because domestic table grapes rank 15th on the EWG's Environmental Working Group's top 20 fruits and vegetables for pesticide residues. So that's definitely worth making sure you buy organic. Lastly, how do you choose them? You want to choose firm, bright, plump clusters that are securely attached to their stems. The stems should always be green. They shouldn't be brown, because brown stems mean older grapes. Once they're harvested, the grapes do not sweeten, so you should choose grapes that are ready to eat. And how you can tell that with a green grape especially is it'll be more of an amber green than a bright green. And fresh green grapes or red grapes can be kept in the refrigerator for up to 3 days in a covered container. And you want to, just the difference between like a fruit where we told you a nectarine, you should bring it out into room temperature to get the best flavor. You want to serve grapes slightly chilled to get the best flavor. So that's your what's in season for the week. And go out there and enjoy them. Pop a bunch in your mouth.
Thanks, Mark. Who knew? You want to have, I always err on the on room temperature on anything. There's only one thing that should be hot in life. Grapes, no, not so. Grapes should be chilled, huh? Mm-hmm. Who knew? Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Thank you. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. That was What's in Season with Mark Mulcahy. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Helge Hellberg. And we're talking about land ethic today, our relationship to the natural world and natural resources. We are honored by our next guest, the president and CEO of the Trust for Public Land, William Rogers. Will Rogers is a known leader, recognized advocate for land conservation. The Trust for Public Land, a national nonprofit that conserves land for people to enjoy as parks, playgrounds, community gardens, farms, historic places, and wilderness, really turning brownfields into urban parks or playgrounds and conserving remote and inspirational wildlands. The Trust for Public Land is the national leader in that. Joining us now from San Francisco, Will Rogers. Will, are you with us?
I'm there, Helga.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. We're talking about Aldo Leopold's work, Land Ethic, Conservation, and a New Relationship to the Natural World that we are so much a part of. When was TPL founded and why? Because that story really laid the kind of the framework for TPL the Trust of Public Land for the last 30 plus years.
Yeah, and if I'm not all that clear, it's because my mouth is still watering from the grape conversation.
Yes.
TPL started almost 40 years ago here in the Bay Area, but as a national organization. And it was, interestingly early on, everyone who joined TPL was given a copy of Leopold's Sand County Almanac. And the land ethic was a major reason for TPL's existence. And the organization came in existence, in a sense, as a counterpoint to the other more traditional conservation organizations focused on plants and critters and biodiversity. Our principal focus is on people. And as a result, we work from the hearts of our cities all the way out to the wilderness, wherever we can have a meaningful relationship with nature. Because it was the belief of the founders of TPL that if people are cut off from nature, it not only is it bad for people, but it's bad for nature. And so,
which is really the opposite of what is, usually it's the separation of humans from any natural environment that makes that in our belief that makes the environment heal. But actually, TPL is saying no, not so. The more we learn from it, and the more we are good stewards, the more it will benefit both.
We believe that, and we believe that that relationship with the land and with nature are profoundly important to human well-being. And we also believe that if you don't connect people with nature, ideally close to home, but really across the spectrum, then you're not going to have a constituency of voters who will support nature and support that stewardship. So, again, vital for people, but vital for nature as well.
And engagement really, really at the root of how you communicate the value that a human without natural and without engaging in a natural world and natural environments are much less human, much less likely also to value what's around us. What's the mission really? I mean, you work in cities, the Trust for Public Land really being a leader from city parks that are kind of wasteland or abandoned years ago, turning that into vital parks, into playgrounds that people can enjoy, but also in remote areas where the Trust for Public Land conserves 20,000 acres of a beautiful hillside that would otherwise have a different fate. Can you talk about the breadth of your work?
I can, and it also tends to be confusing for people. But if you think about the lens through which we work in choosing what we're going to do as being people and their connection with nature, it all does make sense. And that's why, we believe that no child or anyone in America should be more than a 10-minute walk from their local park or garden or a green, safe place to play. And so many people are really cut off from that close to home experience. And so that means that we do a lot of work in cities around the country. And I think as a conservation organization, that's a unique niche that we fill as a national organization. But we also believe on the land, in the land that's threatened by sprawl and development on the edges of our cities, farmland in particular, it's critical to protect that. And then there are remote and inspirational places that are enormously important to our spiritual lives in wilderness areas that may not have as many people through them, but that are profoundly important to our well-being and to our environment. And we're there as well. So we're working across that spectrum. And for us, it's all about what our partners want. What are the communities with whom we work? What are the public agencies with whom we work? What are the places they really care about? And then where we see that that there are no parks or open space, are there abandoned lots or contaminated sites or something that we can reclaim and give communities an opportunity to help plan and design those places so that they can become places to connect with nature.
On an organic conversation today, the president and CEO of the Trust for Public Land, Will Rogers.
So, Will, what was the event or what was the occurrence that, caused TPL to be founded, and what are some of the past projects that people might be aware of?
Let's see. Well, the cradle of the Trust for Public Land was right on the north side of the Golden Gate Bridge in what became the Golden Gate National Recreation Area and the Marin Headlands. And there was a huge proposed development of some 30,000 people that was going to be called Marin Cello. And this was worked on in the mid 60s. And really it was the community organizations coming together and saying, this is around the time of the first Earth Day, just saying, this isn't the best way to use this land. It's an inappropriate place to do this. It's a wonderful resource. Why are we doing this? And at that time, just a number of local activists got involved and figured out a way for that land ultimately to end up in public ownership. And at the same time, the creation of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area happened. And the fellow who really started the Trust for Public Land worked for the Nature Conservancy at the time. And in working on something that really didn't have endangered critter habitat, which is really the driving force behind the Nature Conservancy, he recognized the need for a complementary organization that would really focus on people and wherever people are making that connection with nature. So shortly after the protection of that land from Marin Cello, he founded the Trust for Public Land, and it immediately became a national organization.
And that was some 30-plus years ago.
Almost 40 years ago.
And so now you are that national organization. You are a very trusted partner in hundreds of projects, and they, again, span from large environmental areas that you protect to city parks. What are the newest initiatives that you are most excited about?
Well, we've done, over the years, we've done about, I'd say 4,000 separate projects in communities around the country, maybe 3 million acres, some of them hundreds of thousands of acres, but some of them a quarter acre in an inner city. You know, a couple of things that come to mind recently, we've protected the land above and behind the Hollywood sign called Cahuenga Peak, 150 acres that's now part of Griffith Park. That was probably the highest profile thing that we've ever done. I was on Vatican Radio, which is unusual for me. We protected the woods around Walden Pond, you know, Thoreau's beloved stalking ground, the houses on the street where Martin Luther King grew up. So it's a very broad tapestry that we paint on. We're in the process now of transferring 30-some-odd community gardens in New York City that we helped protect back in the Giuliani administration from sale and development, and that's going ahead. We're excited about that. And then finally, I'd say one that excites me is right in Marin County in San Rafael, close to where TPL was founded, the Canal District in San Rafael. We're working with the city and the neighborhood organizations on a set of community gardens there for a relatively low-income neighborhood that doesn't have a lot of access to gardening.
Yes, and one cannot say which one is more important, the quarter-acre park or the hundreds of thousands of acres in a wilderness that you might never engage with, but you know it's there, and it's critical work that the Trust for Public Land is doing. How can people get involved? You are publicly funded. You have donors. You have people who support your work. As part of every land deal, there's a donation or a portion of that transaction that keeps you going doing this important work. But if people want to learn more about TPL, how can they engage?
Well, please visit our website at tpl.org. And you're right, we are essentially supported by our donors. We're a private nonprofit organization. And if you visit our website, there are a lot of ways that people can get involved. And they can also find out how to get us involved in their communities so that we can help them, whether it's protecting a special place on the edge of town or whether it's really digging in and helping figure out ways to green schoolyards or create community gardens or urban parks. And so it's a two-way street, and we don't exist without partnership or support.
It's so true in life and in work and with nature and the environment. With us, William Rogers, the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Trust for Public Land. And again, if you want to get involved, it's tpl.org. Either if you have a quarter acre of wasteland that you would like to green or turn into a park, TPL is the trusted partner to go to tpl.org. Thank you so much, Will. Keep up the fantastic work.
Right back at you, Helga. Thank you.
Here's to the next 40 years. Yes, thanks so much for joining us today. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helga Hellberg.
And I'm Mark McKay.
And we are back with more on land ethics and our relationship to the natural world. We are talking with the assistant director of the Forest Service, which now is featuring a sustainable curriculum for Forest Service management, right back to the world of Aldo Leopold Moore and the fantastic Holistic Bite with Chef Sita when we come back right after the break. Stay tuned.
I see a mansard roof through the trees. I see a salty message written in the eaves. The ground beneath my feet, the art garbage and concrete. Now the tops of buildings, I can see them too.
Fry
Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Produce is ever-changing, seasons coming and going. At Earls Organic, we have been sourcing solely organic produce for over 20 years. Since 1988, Earls Organic Produce has been establishing strong relationships with growers and developing a deep understanding of the seasons, so you can offer the most delicious organic produce to your customers, staff, and clients year-round. For organic produce, visit Earls Organic Produce at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Hi, my name is Abby Leeson, and I am the co-founder of The Ginger People. You can find our products in natural food stores near you, from delicious ginger drinks, sauces, spreads, ginger chews, baked goods, to skincare products. We love ginger. It's what we do. Add the benefits of ginger to your life, and you get that little kick, too. I am Abby Leeson, and I am with The Ginger People. For inspiration around ginger, go to gingerpeople.com. That's gingerpeople.com.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Helberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today we are discovering relationships and celebrating relationships to the natural world, land ethic, the topic of today. We just heard from Will Rogers, the president and CEO of the Trust for Public Land. And coming up is Sharon DeHart, the assistant director of the U.S. Forest Service Job Corp. Joining us from Golden, Colorado. But before we go into that interview, he is Chef Sita with Your Holistic Bite.
Thank you so much, Helga. Oh, today we are talking about my favorite fruit. I think I say that a lot, but this one actually is my favorite.
You say that
fruit.
Every time, I do. Actually.
Okay, so,
the other food chef actually emailed us on Facebook, said, which
it.
One is
it?
Oh my
it.
God. Oh, I love everything. Okay, so grapes. Oh my God. Grapes. I buy pounds of them when they're in season. And it's funny you say people eat 8 pounds a week, 8 pounds a year. I eat 8 pounds at least in the first couple of months because I can do a pound a week. I love them. And that's because they are inherently snackable. Like, oh my God, they're just so easy to just pop in your mouth and eat so much of them. And they're really good for you. Grapes have a nutritional profile, just like Mark was saying, that's similar to berries. So they're high in antioxidants, and that comes from a phytonutrient called flavonoids. And antioxidants are great at preventing cancer and cardiovascular disease. They also are an anti-inflammatory food. And because inflammation is a culprit in so many diseases, if we can eat more foods that help to calm inflammation in the body, our systems will just be much better. So feel good about eating a pound a week if you're like me.
That's all we ask.
So the best way to eat them, obviously, is by themselves, I think. I mean, I take them with me to the theater instead of like buying gallons of popcorn and you know, Sour Patch Kids. I'll just take grapes and eat those because they're so easy. And I also think that they're so good frozen. You know, like they're great for kids to snack on in the summertime if you freeze them. And they're so easy to freeze, too. If you just put them on a sheet tray and let them freeze individually, then they'll stay separated and you can just pop them into a bag once they're frozen. And then you can even take your frozen grapes and put them into a smoothie in the morning, which I love because I'm such a sucker for that sweet tart flavor. Like, I love sweet tarts and Sour Patch Kids and anything that's sweet and sour together. So I can put them into a breakfast smoothie with yogurt or nut butter and protein powder and greens and all kinds of things, and then feel like I'm eating candy for breakfast. So no guilt there. I also think that grapes are really great in savory dishes. We think of them as being so sweet, but it's a nice balance in maybe a salad. And I love this. It's called a vineyard salad, and it has baby spinach and roasted red peppers, toasted pine nuts, and then halved grapes. And you put a little balsamic vinegar on top, and it's just like the flavors of wine country on your plate. It's so delicious. And if you want to make it a main course, put some goat cheese on it. It's also a really nice pairing with those other flavors. So lots of versatility with grapes there. And you can find the recipe for vineyard salad on our website, anorganicconversation.com, or by visiting us on Facebook, An Organic Conversation. Thanks so much. I'm Chef Sita, and that was your Holistic Bite.
And I want to bite you right now. Why is that always so tasty and tangible? I love that popcorn in the movie theater idea, because it's kind of a, you know, there's not much alternative, but there is. You can just bring a cluster of grapes. That's great. And there's nothing, when you're done, right? There's nothing to dispose afterwards. There's nothing greasy. It's clean. You can still touch the seat, or, I mean, not that people often care, even after popcorn, but hey, it is a better choice. Awesome. All that and more. Chef Sita, your Holistic Bite on Facebook and Organic Conversation. Beautiful. Thanks, Sita. What a pleasure. Who knew? We're talking about relationships to our natural world in today's An Organic Conversation. Land ethic, a term coined by Aldo Leopold, a very early Forest Service manager who really was taught by the natural environment that he worked within to create a new understanding of and for the environment he was working in and part of. So we are grateful to have Sharon DeHart with us today to close the loop, to close the circle, as we are coming back to the U.S. Forest Service, where it all started with Aldo Leopold on today's show. Sharon DeHart is the Assistant Director of the U.S. Forest Service, Job Corps, calling us from the National Office in Golden, Colorado. Sharon, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Sharon, thanks so much for joining us today here on An Organic Conversation. Historically, the U.S. Forest Service has trained youth in the age of 16 to 24 since way back early, since the 1960s. How did it start, and what skills are being taught?
Actually, it started with Lyndon B. Johnson, and the idea is that they wanted to give youth at that particular point in time a livable wage, and so that they would have a more full life. And it was also patterned after some of the things that happened in the Civilian Conservation Corps of 1930 and some of the things that happened in Peace Corps. Therefore, they had Sergeant Shriver also assist them with developing Job Corps centers.
Oh, so really students in the age of 16 to 24 who meet the criteria to enroll in this program get trained in a whole variety of jobs, right? Provide education, vocational instruction, job skill training necessary to then leave this program and get a job in the community.
That is correct. And Job Corps offers, of course, as you said, the academic portion, which could be a high school diploma or a GED. And over 30 trades are offered also in the Job Corps Center, such as carpentry, clerical work, brick masonry, culinary arts, along those lines.
Wow, that's quite a curriculum. Hey, Sharon, this is Mark Mulcahy. Welcome to the show again. And you have a new green curriculum for the Forest Service Job Corps. What are the main points and components of the new green curriculum that the U.S. Forest Service is offering?
The core of the green curriculum, of course, is climate change, green jobs, and sustainability. Mm-hmm. Climate change being, we don't want to create energy. We don't want to use so much energy so that we impact the change in the climate.
Sure.
And then we want to do green jobs, which means that we put insulation in homes, or we don't have the energy vampires that we teach our students. And we talk about sustainability, how to conserve what we do have left already.
Oh. We're talking with Sharon DeHart, the Assistant Director of the U.S. Forest Service Job Corps National Office. from Golden, Colorado, about the new U.S. Forest Service green curriculum. So historically, the Forest Service has trained youth since the 60s. Now this new green curriculum has been around for what, about a year, 12 months, is that right?
Yes, I have.
And so you're really focusing on integrating sustainability measures within the job training that you're offering. And that could be a whole variety, even from office jobs to, as you said, masonry, carpeting, carpenter skills. You integrate how to do it on a lighter carbon footprint within those job training programs. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. We have been doing some of the career jobs for quite some time. And of course, in each state, they have rules and regulations about what you can do. But we ratcheted it up a bit to be a little bit more 21st century in including things like for our carpentry students, they use a lot more insulation, a lot more caulking in our painting trades. In our culinary arts, we find that we can use different ways of growing vegetables that will help us conserve energy. And just in the living of our students on job course centers, we teach them how to clean their clothes using biodegradable products, as well as not using as much water as they would normally use, or to conserve the way we use water when we are in our homes.
So the new green curriculum, even though some of these students might end up working for the U.S. Forest Service, is really more as much a job training for then, you know, moving into the community and getting jobs there, as it is a life training curriculum to live as a steward of this planet on a lighter carbon footprint. Is that right? Am I understanding
that? That is absolutely correct. It becomes a lifelong learning process that we try to give our students, as well as a quality of life process.
That's great, Sharon. So with this new green curriculum that you've launched and that's been ongoing for about a year, have you seen an increase in interest by young folks since you've added the new curriculum?
Actually, I have. I'm glad you asked that. For something as simple as what we call the energy vampires, when you plug in your iPhone or your iPod and you don't unplug it, and we talk about something that they can relate to, such as you're using energy, and therefore when you leave the Job Corps centers, your electrical bill will go up. So if you unplug it at an appropriate amount of time, you know, it decreases your bill. Or, for an instance, if we talk about carpentry or painting, when you're caulking and using insulation, it decreases your utility bills. And we teach it in such a way that they go, aha. And some of those aha moments or the light bulb goes off and say, okay, this makes sense to me.
Yes. Great. That's really great. We all need those aha moments. We're talking with Sharon DeHart, the assistant director of the U.S. Forest Service, about the new green curriculum. And even President Obama has, you know, complimented the U.S. Forest Service for its leadership, you know, saying really this new green curriculum gets young people ready to or more ready, prepares them for green jobs in their local communities. And we know the benefits of green jobs, not just for the environment, but all the benefits for local economies associated with that. What's the feedback that you've gotten from students? Are they excited about this?
Number one, they're excited to be supported in something that is talked about by the president. But number two, coming from some of the environments that our students come from, just learning what the process is to have a better quality of life and, of course, save money and be just a really productive citizen. So the feedback is really positive.
And if young people want to get involved, they can go to your website and learn about it. 16 to 24 year old is the age requirement, and that website is FS as in forestservice.usda.gov, usda.gov. Wonderful. All the information is there. Sharon, so great talking with you. Keep up the wonderful work. It's so important to train, especially youth. Really appreciate the Forest Service taking that leadership role. Great to have you today. Thank you.
Hey, listen, thank you so much.
Okay.
That was Sharon DeHart, the Assistant Director of the U.S. Forest Service Green Job Corps National Office, calling from Golden, Colorado.
So, Helga, while you won't be able to join that Job Corps, you can.
But in a couple of years, I will.
In a couple of years, you'll be able to, yeah, when you're old enough. But you can tell us what's in the mailbag.
The mailbag, yes. Well, we had a bunch of things. There's a Michigan woman, which we might pick up in news next week, but we had a Michigan woman that apparently faces 93 days of jail for planting a vegetable garden in her front yard. There's a city ordinance in that Michigan town that says suitable plants, and apparently it does not include vegetables. So I can only say, may reason prevail. What an opportunity for that city to recognize. And we are not talking about like community living or you know, gated community or any of that. This is like a worker worker area, small homes. It's there's no rhyme or reason to this. But again, this is an opportunity to, you know, change the city ordinance, I would say.
It's exactly an opportunity. And just like the opportunity from we get comments from listeners all over the planet, Australia, Peru, Germany, Chihuahua, Mexico.
Right. Yes, because we are on more and more stations around the country, and some of these stations, or many, most of them, actually air an Organic Conversation online, which is worldwide. And so, yes, if you listen to this, wherever you are, whatever your world is, your block where you live, or any part of the country, or any part of this planet, or even outside of the planet, please email us to
share@anorganicconversation.com, and you can become part of an organic conversation wherever you are.
But you already are part of an organic conversation wherever you are.
Absolutely. Yes, that's true. Which leads us to the end of the show and Helga's organic moment. Helga?
Yes. So the theme for me today was truth. We know. There's a beautiful green fire quote right back to Aldo Leopold in this new beautiful documentary where he wrote, "We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then and have known ever since that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and the mountain. I was young then, full of trigger itch. I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean hunter's paradise. But after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view." Aldo Leopold, Sand County Almanac, 1949. I love this quote for many reasons. For Aldo Leopold being able to change his longtime opinion, being an avid hunter himself, for being committed to his truth rather than to his beliefs, which at that moment were from the past. And truth is a tricky one. It can be difficult to accept at times. We can suppress it. We cannot pay attention. We can try to avoid it, speak over it. We can try to argue it away. But whatever our relationship is to truth, it is nevertheless always true.
And that was this week's edition of An Organic Conversation. An Organic Conversation is a production of the Organic Media Network. Associate producer is Gina Rustani.
If you missed parts of this show or for any other show, go to iTunes or anorganicconversation.com. We are your hosts, Helge Hellberg.
And Mark Mulcahy.
And we will be back right here, same place, same time next week.
Bye-bye.
Headed down south to the land of the pines. I'm thumbing my way to North Carolina. Staring up the road and pray to God I see headlights. I made it down the coast in 17 hours. Picking me a bouquet of dogwood flowers. And I'm hoping for Raleigh I could see my baby tonight.